Hello, here is your KVNF regional newscast for Wednesday, July 11th. Democratic nominee for governor of Colorado, U.S. Representative Jared Polis, visited Delta last week with his lieutenant governor running mate, Diane Primavera. So far, we've heard his comments about fracking, gun control, health care, and education. Here's the final segment of Allie Lightfoot's interview.
Okay, and my final question has to do with campaign financing. It seems like when you look at some of the candidates, there's a direct connection between how much money they raised and how much success they have in their campaign. Why does it cost so much to run for office, and what ideas do you have on how people who don't have the money to run could actually participate as a candidate?
Well, I think that most voters vote for the candidate who they believe will best help them in their lives and improve our state or improve our country. I meet a few voters who voted for me because they know I don't take special interest or PAC money. It's certainly a plus, but that maybe gets you to 2 or 3% of the vote. The way you win is by really having the policies and the plans to save people money on health care, to show that we're the one that will protect their quality of life, our parks and open space and our environment. You can learn more about our plans to keep Colorado wild at PolisForColorado.com, where we talk about how we need to preserve our state lands and outdoor areas for our recreation and enjoyment, as well as the important role they play in the economy and job creation.
Your policies, you're able to get them out there, though, because you have the money to do that. So I'm wondering, like, if you see anything in the future in terms of how you finance campaigns that would allow people who don't have hundreds of thousands of dollars, but still may have great policy ideas.
Well, I'm a strong supporter of campaign finance reform, meaning we need to end the stranglehold that special interests have over our politicians, and I support matching public funds for small donations. Where there's models that work at the state level, including the state of Maine, that has a state finance system for clean money in state legislative and statewide elections. And I think if something like that were to be put on the ballot here in Colorado, it would be widely popular among Republicans, Independents, and Democrats as a way of getting big money out of politics.
Thank you.
In our most recent story from Western Slope Resources Reporting, we learn about fighting fire with fire. It may seem contradictory, but as KBUT's Christopher Biddle reports, prescribed burns are one of the best tools firefighters have to prevent wildfires.
Prescribed burns are a useful, albeit risky, tool against the increasing danger of wildfires in the western United States. But in the country that gave us Smokey the Bear, how do you convince the public that more frequent fires are the way to go? One way? Data. In 2011, Santa Fe National Forest in New Mexico experienced what was, at the time, the largest wildfire in state history, the Las Conchas Fire.
Its initial rate of spread, it burned like 40,000 acres overnight. It was burning an acre a second for about 14 hours straight.
That's Jonathan Koop, a professor at Western State Colorado University in Gunnison. Like any forestry expert living in the western United States in the past century, he pays close attention to how land managers deal with wildfire.
We're concerned about changing fire regimes across the western U.S. and globally, and what the implications are on our forested systems.
One of the greatest challenges with using fire as a tool on the landscape is a public aversion to it.
That's Ryan Walker, a graduate student at Western State and the lead author of a study published in the journal Ecosphere, co-authored by Koop and researchers from the U.S. Forest Service and the National Park Service.
This study really complements research that's been going on for probably the past two decades that have recognized this effect of our policy of fire suppression.
Within the more than 150,000 acres that burned in the Las Conchas Fire were pockets that had seen either man-made or naturally occurring fires, or in some cases, both. They wanted to know if those pockets had recovered more successfully. They combined satellite imagery with data collected in the field. Their findings may not surprise you. Here's Jonathan Koop.
Places that had had the most fire in the past were the most likely to have forests still persisting through this really big fire that came through. It was really extreme.
This isn't exactly a new idea in the field of wildfire management. Long gone are the days since the Forest Service were issued a now infamous directive to have all wildfires extinguished by 10 a.m. the next day. But the residual effects of those policies remain.
The recognition is there, but the culture of fire suppression is so ingrained that we're still not letting fires burn as they should, as they normally would have.
Again, here's lead author Ryan Walker.
We were building on that understanding that fire is a necessary process, and when you remove that process, we wind up with adverse conditions that can lead to a catastrophic event. We knew that there was some nuance there that could be teased apart. And that nuance was this succession of treatments, applications, prescribed fire, managed fire. There are all of these recommendations that these things should be used.
It's really challenging to go for land managers to go out there and just start applying fire everywhere. Because first of all, there's houses out there. And people are scared. Well, what happens if that fire gets away and comes down and burns the community? And that happens sometimes. You know, there are risks.
Hundreds of homes, thousands of acres, gone up in smoke.
Just watch them burn one by one.
It wasn't supposed to happen this way. This fire was deliberately.
That's Dateline NBC's coverage of the Cerro Grande fire in 2000. It was a prescribed burn that jumped the fire lines. 400 homes were destroyed. The U.S. government estimated total damages at $1 billion. 11 years later, the Las Conchas fire dwarfed what had been the state's largest by more than 60,000 acres. However, it was mostly wildland areas that were affected, with a comparatively small number of homes destroyed.
Some other researchers went back, and they determined that if it hadn't been for that Cerro Grande fire, Las Conchas fire would have gone in and probably just wiped out most of that town. But because of that Cerro Grande fire, which is huge, like really traumatic incident, going out there, putting this prescribed fire out there to try and do ecological benefit and unintentionally having this huge adverse consequence, but that put a huge fuel break between, you know, the mountains and the town that probably saved the town.
That's likely a difficult message for those who lost their homes in the Cerro Grande fire. It's not the sort of thing that researchers like Walker and Coop typically get into. In their eyes, their job is to keep information coming in order to hone the best practices in the field. Reporting for Western Slope Resources Reporting, I'm Christopher Biddle.
This story is part of Western Slope Resources Reporting, a collaboration between KBUT, KSJD, and three other radio stations in rural Colorado, made possible with support from the Gates Family Foundation.
And that was your KVNF regional newscast for Wednesday. For KVNF News, I'm Eric Gould. Thanks so much for listening.